Accession number 4427, Reel 1.
Brigadier MacNab, Reel 1. How did you come to join the army in the first place, Brigadier MacNab?
Well, it all started with Cameron Halder led soldiers when I was about 6. And I said I wanted to be a Cameron Halder. And my father, who was in the Indian Army, actually he was a surgeon in the Indian Medical Service, married my mother when she was 18, and she was the daughter of a general who was out in India, and all her brothers were in the Indian Army, Indian Cavalry, PAVO, I think what are called Bengal Lancers.
What does PAVO stand for?
Prince Albert somebody, I don't honestly know. Anyway, it was a great Indian connection. My father was very keen for me to go into the Guides Infantry, and he'd been regimental medical officer to them for a long time. And I said no, I wanted to be a Cameron Hounder. I was a Scotsman. I wanted to wear a kilt. I wore a kilt at that time at the age of 6, and I wanted to be a Cameron Hounder. That's how it all started.
And how did you get your Africa posting?
Well, after 3 years, I found that 10 and fourpence a day, £16 a month, and what my father could afford to let me have, which was £100 a year allowance, I just couldn't do all the things that I was doing without getting into trouble. And as it was amazing what one could do. We were then stationed, after coming back from Rhein Army, Wiesbaden, we were in Redford Barracks in Edinburgh, and I had what we called a 15 bobber, a horse from the Greys, which I kept down at Melrose. I had a half share in a car, and I hunted with the Buccleuch and the Lauderdale for £12 a month. But my pay was only £16 a month. And my mess bill was about 25, what with washing and one thing and another, and it just didn't add up. And a great friend of mine who'd been in the same company had gone off to the 4th King's African Rifles, who were in Uganda, and he wrote me letters saying that he was up in a place called Karamojo, which was 2.5 times the size of Wales, and he and one other chap and the district commissioner were the only two people, only three people in it. So I thought, well, there's a feeling of adventure. He told me he got £500 a year, tax-free, which seemed absolute riches to me. And so, really, basically, because of lack of money, I decided to try and join him. I think also a sense of adventure. But I can't say that it was anything really more than necessity see I didn't get too much into debt.
And was it difficult to get into the KAR, or was it more or less a formality?
Well, at the time I went, you had to apply through the colonial office, and there was a chap called Major Coles or some name like that, who did both West Africa and the King's African Rifles. And in those days, it was a question of luck as to whether there was a waiting list or whether there wasn't. You had to be recommended by your commanding officer, of course. And then, if you had good enough reasons, you could apply to go to a certain battalion. And, of course, I felt that I had, because this fellow, David MacDonald, in my regiment had gone there. And the 4th King's African Rifles, in fact, had, out of the 8 active officers in the country at the time, I think 6 of them were in Highland Regiments in that particular battalion, 4th KAR. So I plumped for that one and was very lucky to get it.
And did you have to have an interview?
I had an interview in London, in the colonial office, with this staff officer. After he'd read what the commanding officer had to say about me. And I waited, I think, about 2 months. Then the posting came through.
And what about the preparations for going out to Africa?
Well, you were given a book by the Colonial Office through the Crown agents, I think, and it gave you advice on, in fact, they gave you a little booklet on health and saying you didn't get fever and so on. And the thing that amused me was that inside the book it said, "This book is bound with a special preparation to guard it against the ravages of insects."
And did it?
No. The white ants ate it just the same.
And did this book give you any advice on how to behave towards the African population there? Or did they just leave you to
No,
your own discretion?
They didn't, as far as I remember, no. No, I think one got that really from when you arrived there and talked to other people and so on. I wouldn't swear they didn't, but I can't remember it. They might have done. But I don't remember sort of reading it. I do remember that it said that sometimes whiskey in the tropics was essential.
Why was that?
I think that a lot of people thought that it kept malaria away. You got pickled.
Do you think there's any truth in it?
No.
What about kitting out for going to Africa?
Well, there was you were recommended to a fellow called, I think his name was Gore, W.H. Gore, who was a sort of tropical outfitter. And he was off the Haymarket, I think. And one was advised, you see, in my case, I had this chap, David MacDonald, and he wrote and he said, well, don't get a whole lot of stuff. Just get one bush shirt and one pair of shorts, and then we get them copied by the regimental tailor when you arrive. And so I didn't buy a whole lot of things. I bought things like a safari bath with a basket inside it so that you could put clothes in the basket, you see, and that could be carried on a porter's head. Things like that. In fact, I got tips, and I think that the Colonial Office also sent a list of things that you should have. But thanks to David MacDonald, I didn't spend a lot of money at Gore's buying all sorts of extra things. I bought a rifle and
a sporting rifle
and a cheap shotgun. But I didn't spend an awful lot of money on in fact, I hadn't got it. That was the reason for going out there.
Was shooting or big game hunting one of the attractions for you in going to East Africa?
I took it in, but I wasn't sort of... Before I went there, I wasn't mad keen on it. It was a sort of feeling behind me, a sort of sense of adventure that I would like to do it. But I didn't go there for that reason initially. Although it did become a tremendous interest to me as a result of going there, I hadn't gone there for doing it.
What about the voyage out to East Africa? How did you actually get there?
Very pleasant. Llandaff Castle. Going at about, I suppose, 11 or 12 knots. And it took, well, over nearly a month going through the Suez Canal. And it was all great fun. And there was another fellow who I'd never met before in my life called Claude Reynolds, the South Wales Borderers. And I said, where are you going to? We're in the same cabin. And he said, I'm going to a place called Bombo, Uganda. I said, so am I. And Claude Reynolds and I became great friends and had a lot of fun together.
And where was your port of disembarkation?
Mombasa. Then we went up in the train to Nairobi. In those days, you arrived simply covered in red dust. People started off with white faces, ended up with red faces by the time they got to Nairobi. Of course, you saw a tremendous lot of game in the early mornings as you arrived. into Nairobi Station. And then we went to find out how we were to get to Uganda. And we were told that the Clement Hill, which was the steamer, there wasn't a train in those days to Jinja in Uganda. You had to go across Lake Victoria in a boat called the Clement Hill. And we were told, oh, well, no, the Clement Hill, it only goes twice a week. So we had another week sort of hanging about in Nairobi before we could ever join the 4th King's African Rifles.
What did you do with your week in Nairobi?
Oh, we sort of pottered about looking at the museums and generally what tourists do.
And so when you eventually got your steamer, what was the trip across Lake Victoria like?
It's rather hot and it was rather sort of humid, you know. But I don't remember it awfully well somehow. It wasn't one of the highlights of the thing.
Can you remember your reception at Bombo?
We were met in Kampala and motored out there. But I honestly can't remember anything about it.
But you knew already that you were going out to Karamoja, did
you? Oh, yes, but I stayed at the headquarters until I had to pass my Kiswahili exam, you see. I wasn't sent up country. Nobody was sent up country until they could talk to the soldiers, because none of the soldiers spoke English in those days at all. And so you had to pass them. It wasn't a very difficult test, but it was what they called a KR, Kiswahili test. And you really got a vocabulary and strung the words together without much grammar attached to it.
How did you set about learning? Was it from a book or from a teacher?
Well, you had a book, and I used to get the company clerk, who spoke English and Swahili, and I learned from the company clerk. I used to have half an hour a day from the company clerk. And then I had a book, a Swahili book. But if you tried to do it too grammatically, it was a complete failure, because then the soldier didn't understand you, because he himself had to learn Swahili. It was a trading language, and it wasn't his own tribal language, you see. It's a coastal language.
So the soldiers themselves would have spoken in a kind of pidgin,
yes,
Swahili.
In fact, the whole thing was Kikr, really. It wasn't Kiswahili at all.
Key meaning language.
For instance, well, sort of rather overdoing it, I don't know. The Kikr would be Mimi Apana Jua, me not know. Whereas the real sentence is Sijui, which is quite different. But that's the proper Kiswahili would be Sijui. But the KR used to say Mimi Apana Jua.
And so how long did you have to spend at headquarters then?
I think I spent 3 or 4 months. Yes, I think it was 3 or 4 months. And at that particular time, things were happening. When I first went out there, the 4th KR was entirely on its own. It was administered as a completely separate outfit, and it had its own quartermaster, paymaster set up, and we ordered our stuff direct from the Crown agents at home and all that, you see. But then the brigade system started, and they started brigading the King's African Rifles battalions in Kenya and Uganda. We had 2 battalions in Kenya and 1 battalion in Uganda, and that became the Northern Brigade. And then you had the 2 Nyasaland battalions and the Tanganyika Battalion in Tanganyika and Yaslan, and they became the Southern Brigade.
When did that brigading system come in?
That came in, it started to function about the middle of 1930. But when I went out at the end of 29, it hadn't started. It was going to happen. And, of course, it led to the usual British disease of saying, why should we get to be made to do the same thing as somebody else, you know? Because we had effendis, native officers. We were very proud of these effendis. And they were all newbies. And, in fact, they were the descendants of the fellows Lugard brought down to conquer Uganda in the first case. And they lived in settlements. One settlement was at Bombo. And they made up a sort of NCO class, almost, in the Fourth King's African Rifles, and to a certain extent in the Kinyabatans too. But of course, they didn't exist in Tanganyika. And indeed, Idi Amin has got a lot of newbie in him, although he's a Kakwa, West Nile, Arua. He's got a tremendous lot of newbie blood in him, and they made very good soldiers. They were cruel people, but they made awfully good soldiers. And as I say, we used them a lot as NCOs. Practically all the company sergeant majors were newbies. And we had one effendi who was a captain, Captain Abukir effendi. I was quite windy of him when I arrived. As a young subaltern I was, and there he was. He saluted me, but at the same time, I had a great respect for him.
He was quite an imposing character, wasn't he?
Yes. They were rarely very venal, but their system of discipline was quite different to ours. And I think very much more effective in many ways. For instance, if a chap had a dirty rifle, you would give him 3 days to barracks or whatever it was. Whereas the effendi would say, you've got a dirty rifle, you see to it, you bring me 3 pounds of sugar and hand it over to my wife. And in that way, he finds the chap, really.
And the troops dislike that much more than confined to barrels.
Yes, oh yes.
Did you allow them to do that? Or?
Well, one turned a blind eye to it, really. As long as it didn't become... if the chaps didn't complain and the discipline was kept and everybody was happy, it was a good thing just not to... All I noticed was we used to keep the pay sheets of the whole company. Effendi's pay sheet, he got whatever it was a month, but he never seemed to draw any pay, but he always seemed to live very well.
He never used to draw his pay?
Well, he didn't. It went on accumulating on his pay sheet, you see.
But presumably he would draw it eventually.
Oh, yes, he'd draw it eventually, but he was living on the fines that he was imposing.
And were the newbie offenders in charge of newbie troops, or were they of different tribes?
Oh, no, no. So they weren't. They were platoon commanders, really, or sometimes sort of supernumerary to the. You only have one company commander and probably one other officer in each company, you see. Not like we had in the war, where you had 32 British officers in the King of the African Rifles Battalion. In those days, we worked on company commander and probably one subaltern to each company.
Earlier on, you were talking about the changeover to the brigade system, and you gave me the impression that there was some grumbling about this. Changeover of system. In what way was their resistance to it?
Well, you know how people like to be different. One hates to be regimentated into one thing. And, of course, you see, once the Uganda battalion was brigaded, with the two battalions in Kenya. Well, they had an authority in Nairobi over what went on in Uganda in the King's African Rifles. I'm not talking politically in any way, merely from the point of view of the subaltern, the young subaltern at the time. I hated the idea of having a brigade commander interfering with our peculiar habits in the 4th King's African Rifles, our Effendis and so on.
So it was rather disliked because it entailed a certain loss of independence?
Yes.
Freedom of action?
Yes, yes.
And were you saying earlier on that this changeover to the brigade system affected the Effendi system in some way?
Well, yes, because it was decided in Nairobi, where the headquarters of the brigade was, that they would no longer have Effendis. And so we had to let our Effendis die out. In fact, no more Effendis were made. They weren't sacked or anything. We had, right up to the time I left the 4th KR, which was, 2 years later, we had Kenyon Kerala, who was a second lieutenant, and he was allowed to gradually die out, you know, when his time for discharge came. And then no more were made. Until 1956, when it was decided that the King's African Rifles, we had to have some officers, African officers, and there was objections in Uganda from the governor of the time. Because there were a lot of British troops there. And it was a question of whether the British troops would salute the black officers and so on. And it all became very tricky. So we said, well, let's go back and start up the Effendis again, who were native officers. And they weren't saluted. So therefore, there was no trouble about whether British army people would salute the African officers and all that. Looking back on it all now, it's fantastically stupid. But it isn't all that long ago. It's only 25 years ago. Anyway, the Effendis came back again, and they lasted up to the date of independence of each of the territories. And indeed, Idi Amin was pushed through an Effendis examination because of his natural powers of leadership. His English was appalling, and his map reading was hopeless, but he was such a figure of I don't know what it was about him. I think he's one of the best company sergeant majors I ever saw. He was a champion shot of the battalion, a heavyweight boxer of Uganda. He used to babysit for his company commander's wife, and he was a most genial, nice chap in those days.
So in those days, one couldn't have
expected to become the monster. You couldn't expect that he'd become the monster he did. He wasn't in the war. He was a bellboy at Kampala Hotel. In fact, how he joined or what, whether he was press ganged. I forgot to say about the newbies. The custom was, although they wanted to be soldiers, a lot of them, and it was in their blood, and their fathers had been in their grandfathers, it was not regarded as the thing to enlist. And so you had to put up a show of press-ganging them. And the way it was done was at Bombo, well, there was a big settlement of them, you had a football match, a soccer match. And just before the final whistle blew, the regimental police would arrest every likely-looking newbie, you see. And, in fact, the adjutant had gone round with the Effendis and said, he looks a likely chap, and you know about his father, and so on. And they decided, really, who they were going to arrest. And, of course, these fellows turned up. They knew they were going to be arrested. They turned up to the football match, and they were arrested before final whistle, clapped in the guard room, and told that they were going to be soldiers. And they said, no, no. All right, no food. So they didn't get any food that night. The following morning, the same thing. You're going to be soldiers. No, no food. Well, the ones that surrendered, the first, didn't make anything like as good soldiers as the ones who stuck it out for 2 or 3 days. And the ones that lasted the longest became, eventually, the company's on measures and things of the future.
But they all eventually consented, did they?
Yes. But they wanted to be.
They really knew all the time that they were going to...
It was undignified. It wasn't done to volunteer. You had to be wanted so much that they'd arrest you. And then you had to pretend jolly hard that you didn't want to be a soldier.
So it was a kind of maidenly coyness.
Yes.
Playing hard to get.
That's it.
Coming back to the abolition of the Effendi system, and you said it was phased out. Whilst it was being phased out, did the existing Effendis continue to act as Effendis until they actually retired?
Yes, rather.
So it must have taken quite a few years for the system to
die out. Yes, it did. In fact, they were still going when I left the 4th KR, but they didn't have them in the 3rd KR, which I went to afterwards. But, you see, another thing that we had was, very stupidly, I suppose, looking at with hindsight, we had tribal companies. For instance, in Uganda, when I first arrived, they had a complete Acholi company, A company. And it rather taught us a lesson, because the Acholi company was lent to Kenya to go up to a place called Lokichung in Turkana. And they were sent up there without their wives. And it was quite a tough going, and in those days we hadn't got our own transport and so on. And the commanding officer promised A company that they would have their wives within 3 months. But what he didn't realize was that the rains made it completely impassable, and they couldn't get their wives up there. And being in a complete tribal company, the whole tribe all together in one company, they sat down and, well, virtually it was a mutiny. But of course, they didn't know that it was a mutiny. They just refused to soldier on at the time. And it was a jolly good lesson to everybody not to have these tribal companies and to mix them up. And furthermore, another thing to lesson, certainly to me, was that you must never, never promise an African something you can't fulfill. They're very childish like that. You know, if you say to your child, your son, if you do so-and-so, I'll give you so-and-so, and you don't give it to him, well, that's terrible.
And a change in policy for mixing the tribes came about as a result of
that
particular
situation. It certainly did in the 4th KR. I don't know, I didn't know the other battalions in those days, but certainly it did influence the 4th KR.
What date was this?
Middle 30s. And you see, it was intensely interesting, the whole thing, from being a subaltern in a Highland regiment at home, doing the normal sort of duties and so on. You went out there, and when you were faced with the first platoon, they all looked exactly alike. You couldn't tell one man from another, and you were almost in despair. You say, well, how on earth am I ever going to fit names to faces in this outfit? And in a very short space of time, everybody had the personality and different features and everything, just as if they were Europeans. And indeed, you could tell by the smell which tribal lot you were with, because what you eat is how you smell. And the Maganda used to eat bananas, and they smelled quite different to the Acholi, who used to have posho.
The Maganda used to eat what, and bananas?
Bananas. They lived on bananas. And they smelled, when they took off their shirts in the early morning for PT and did arm swinging or whatever it was, you knew jolly well, even with your eyes shut, what sort of a platoon was in front of you.
You said earlier about the Acholi unit not being able to take their wives up to the frontier area. Was there any provision made for them to take Turkana women as temporary wives?
No.